everybody, welcome to F This Movie. Happy October, it is scary movie month at F This Movie. So tonight, we're talking about the Universal Monsters, and I am joined by a man who is universally considered a monster. JB!
I am so excited about this.
JB knows more about Universal Monsters than anyone in the world.
Welcome to my nightmare, and at the risk of using a cliche, this is my wheelhouse. We finally took 2 years. We finally got to my wheelhouse.
Scary Movie Month has been going unbelievably well at F This Movie.
Well, with a caveat.
Yes, we'll get to that in 1 second. If you aren't participating yet, go to fthismovie.net. And take part in the Scary Movie Challenge Part 3, where you watch any horror movie during October, and then you write a 7-word review. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com and click on the podcast tab. Thanks to Michael Staley and everyone.
And in 2 weeks, you will find us at the Portage Theater enjoying the recently moved Massacre.
24 hours of horror movies. Make sure you listen to our podcast on that. You can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Back to the Scary Movie Challenge. So every year we do this thing called the Scary Movie Challenge. The first year I think we wanted to get like 50 comments. We got just over 100. Right? Do I have that right? Or did we want to get 100 and we got just over?
First year we got 3.
The second year I think we wanted to get 150 and we got 400 something. And so this year we set the bar at 400. And
well, you set the bar at 400.
Yes, whatever.
I set the bar at 1,000.
We are well on our way.
To 1,000.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that we run into. Usually, you know, we start off with a commentary track, and then usually JB and I do sort of the first official podcast of Scary Movie Month. And we have, I don't know, 30 different comments to choose from.
Yes.
To read, which we like to do.
This was harder.
As of this recording, we have
275.
Yeah, closing in on 300, so we have 10 times as many. So thank you to everybody who has been kicking much ass.
But this meant we had to be more selective.
On the Scary Movie Challenge. If we don't read your comment, we are sorry. We hope that you will keep commenting, because it has been going great, and I hope everybody's having a lot of fun doing it so far.
I'm going to read the ones that made me laugh out loud. If your 7-word review only made me titter, it didn't make
it
the cut.
It doesn't get read? Okay.
But before we read the good ones,
yeah.
School marm Patrick has to lay down the law.
Here's the deal. And I posted a little bit about this on the actual thread at fthismovie.net. But again, we appreciate everybody chiming in. Make sure that you are watching a horror movie. Don't try and get funny and watch Team America and post about Team America. Someone did that. And there's been some side conversation in the comments thread. We've never had that in the past in the Scary Movie Challenge thread, so it's never been anything we've had to deal with. I don't want to be the police. I don't want to just shut people down, because I like that people are talking to one another and having conversations. At the same time, I am going to have to go through at a certain point and delete those sort of side conversations. So here's what I'm thinking. If you guys have comments that you want to make on other people's reviews or the movies they've seen, that's fine. That's great. Go ahead and do it. I'll leave them up for about a week so that whoever you're talking to has a chance to respond, read what you wrote, whatever. So you guys want to have a conversation, go ahead. But after about a week, I'm going to go through and delete anything that isn't a 7-word review. And that's not to be an a-hole. That's just so that we have an accurate count of here's how many 7-word reviews we have.
And Patrick, I think that's more than fair. Patrick hands JB a dog treat.
So I'm going to do the first purge pretty soon. So if you guys have...
But have you done the first binge?
I binge
actually,
every day.
Yeah, that the 275 yeah. reviews are the
yeah,
binge.
Yeah, that is quite a binge.
And now here comes the purge. Also, and we've talked about this every year, before you hit publish...
count the words.
Count the words again. I went through all of them to pick out my favorite ones.
Yeah.
I was really surprised.
Are there a bunch that aren't 7?
Oh, you bet.
Really?
You bet.
Shoot, I don't want to have to go through and count the words on all of them. Yikes. Yeah, please do. That saves me some work if you have 7 words.
There was one I really liked, and I said, wait a minute, just saying it out loud in my head. That
I didn't
sounds a
words.
Little short.
I didn't count the words on the ones I chose. I wonder if I read any six-worders. Anyway, let's read some
of our
favorites.
What I'm talking about was a six-worder. Okay. In any case,
yes.
I apologize if I'm going to mispronounce names, because some of these people have been with us for a long time, and we really appreciate the fact that you've come to join the party. Cameron?
Yes.
Claudier?
Yes.
His review of Firestarter. Drew Barrymore as a child scares me. I thought that was great.
I'm going to read one from Clint J., who reviews John Carpenter's The Thing. Never trust a dog or Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, that one almost made the cut, but I discovered when I finished that I had way too many Clint J. Clint J., whoever you are, you're very clever. Longtime F This Movie listener Ross Reeder posts about the original version of Pulse. J. Horror meets The Social Network. Nightmares follow. If you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about.
John Murphy had a couple that I wanted to read. I picked my favorite, his review of Dawn of the Dead. Brains, 2-for-1 in American Eagle.
Did I miss that one?
It's a good one.
That doesn't sound... Is it recent?
No.
Oh,
I don't think so. I think that was one of the early... That was from October 1st.
I must have missed that one. Speaking of Clint J., having seen this film several hundred times, Clint J.'s review of the original Nosferatu. When cutting bread, thumb placement is important.
That's kind of a deep cut.
I
was not going for a pun there.
That's such an iconic scene in the original Nosferatu. Yeah. When I rewatched Dracula for the Blu-ray box, I remembered that scene incorrectly. In the 1931 Dracula, it looks like a paper cut, but then later Dwight Fry says that it was a paper clip.
Hmm.
He cuts his... That scene in Nosferatu is so iconic with Hooter. I think in Nosferatu, the character's named Hooter.
It sounds like a character from, like, Revenge of the Nerds.
Well, you know, they were skirting copyright, and they gave everyone different names. It's not Harker. It's Hooter. The Nosferatu scene is so iconic, I thought it was in the original Dracula.
Here's one from Greg Talbot, his review of Cabin in the Woods, which has been reviewed a lot. A lot of different people have been watching Cabin in the Woods, which is great. Everybody should see that movie. Bong Hitter outwits eggheads, changes the world. Very nice.
I thought that was great. And Sal O.
Yes.
Has an alternate review of Cabin in the Woods. I wish they had picked the unicorn. That was great.
I like the ones where you sort of have to have seen the movie to really appreciate the joke. Heath Holland, or as he prefers to be called, Hollywood Heath, reviewed The Corpse Bride, Burton's Players Going Through the Stop Motions.
Yeah, you had said yesterday that you liked that one.
Very clever.
John Murphy reviews Sleepaway Camp, which we did a memorable audio commentary.
That was my other pick for John Murphy. I went with Dawn of the Dead, but...
John Murphy's 7-word review of Sleepaway Camp contains scariest corn water death ever filmed.
Corn water. Michael Shaw reviews House of 1,000 Corpses. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run.
Oh, yeah. The first time I read that, it took me a little while to get it. Steve K. reviews the original Halloween and says, beware or the Steadicam will get you.
I think I had that one, too. I must have skipped right over it, because it's funny how we liked all the same ones. I'll read one more from Scott Tex, who reviews 1981's Jaws of Satan, a movie I've never seen. Motherfucking snakes on a motherfucking train.
Yeah, I almost wrote that one down, too. One of our favorite listeners, one of our more popular listeners, Anonymous, reviews It, the TV movie based on the, and Patrick already remembers this one, reviews It, the TV movie version of Stephen King's epic. His 7-word review, I shit myself twice while watching this. And I wonder if he's being sarcastic.
Probably not.
That wraps up the scary movie review for this week. Keep posting.
Yeah.
The first time I let slip, the first time I put into words, the first time I was bold enough to say it out loud, Patrick looked incredulous, but I think we're going to hit 1,000 this year. I really do.
Yeah, I hope so. That would be amazing.
I haven't gotten started yet.
Yeah, that would be great. Keep posting. We'll keep reading them. We'd love to see the number go up every day. Jay Bones, have you seen anything scary lately?
Yes, although I'm not sure if it was trying to be scary. Friday night, I went to see Frankenweenie.
Yes.
Because I cannot be taught. I thought it might rinse the bad taste out of my mouth from Dark Shadows, something I called the worst movie of the last 5 years. I saw it in IMAX and 3D because I have money to burn, and I thought that would somehow add to the experience. It was very interesting. The theater was full of little kids, and my guess is they were there for various showings of Frankenweenie.
Probably.
There really isn't a
lot. Oh, that other one, Hotel Transylvania.
So let's assume they were there for one of the two. And this was a screening at like 6 o'clock at night, perfect for kids who have early bedtimes, on the day that it opens. My wife and I walk into the IMAX theater, which is huge at the theater we frequent, 10 people. So my conclusion was parents are no longer paying the premium.
It's not worth it.
For IMAX or 3D. And maybe because people assume because it's IMAX or because it's 3D, there's a special line of sight or something. There's easily 1,000 seats in that theater.
Sure.
The 10 of us were lumped.
Always.
It's...
Always. Especially with the IMAX theater, but yeah, because I don't think 3D does it, but IMAX, everybody goes right to the center.
Everyone wants to be dead center. Yeah. And it was very annoying. Yeah. Although, in their defense, everyone quieted down when the film started. I went expecting to hate it. I didn't hate it, but I was surprised at how completely unmoved, unentertained, it was nothing.
And again, it's a movie that should be working on you, especially because it's speaking to something that you love.
It's very by the numbers. The first half is unbelievably slow, especially for a children's film. I like the character design, but it's nothing we haven't seen before. Martin Landau does a terrific job. He voices this minor character of the science teacher that's kind of a highlight of the movie. Once the plot really starts to get started, it's really nothing. It's the movie equivalent of meh. Meh. And oddly enough, and I had mentioned this to you yesterday at a social occasion, I'm not outstandingly sensitive to this, but there's a part of the movie that I really think is racist.
Yeah.
Especially for 2012. And maybe someone would say, it's not racist, it's an example of inclusion, or that they need this racist element to make this joke later on pay off. But if you're engaging in outrageous, awful ethnic stereotypes to make a joke pay off, well, that's racism.
Yes.
That doesn't excuse it, that's the definition.
Right.
It's just nothing.
And it sounds as though no one went to see it. It opened maybe in fifth place.
And I also get the feeling that because Tim Burton has become a brand name, clearly this was based on his earlier short film. And as many critics have pointed out, big problems expanding into feature length. It's very, very padded. But he produced it and directed it, but he didn't design the characters this time. There's this...
But why do they look so much like the other characters that he supposedly did design?
There's a prominent credit, characters designed by, and it's like this brand name of two people's names who also made the puppets.
Got it.
And he didn't write the script this time.
Okay.
And because it's stop motion, it's not like Burton's there every day actually moving the puppets.
Right.
So I thought it was a case of when Wes Anderson did Fantastic Mr. Fox, they emailed him the footage every day, and he looked it over and sent them notes because they like did it in Czechoslovakia or something where the labor is cheaper. That he's this brand name.
Right.
And I wonder how much actual participation he had on it other than sort of putting a stamp of approval on it.
It's interesting, too, that the point at which, I mean, he's been a brand name in certain circles for a long time, but the point at which he really became a brand name is also the point at which all his movies became terrible.
And again, as I pointed out to you yesterday, sorry I keep bringing up this party conversation that none of you were party to.
You guys should have come.
Danny Elfman's score is beyond. He plagiarizes from himself. It's so derivative of his earlier, better work that you sit there and you hear strains of every other thing he's ever done, specifically Batman this time. It's odd.
Everyone's kind of on autopilot at this point, and rather than come up with new ideas, which is debatable that Tim Burton has come up with new ideas in the last 10 to 15 years. He's just taking existing properties and making them look Tim Burton-esque. But at this point now, he's just literally cannibalizing himself and redoing stuff that he's already done, just in longer form. And he's hiring his friends to do things that they've already done. And
watching Frankenweenie made me remember that the score for Ed Wood, which I think is Tim Burton's best film, is actually by Howard Shore. It's not by Danny Elfman,
yeah,
which is odd. Final comment. I think on the poster, I don't remember what the tagline is. I don't know if there is one. But the tagline on the poster, the poster should read, Tim Burton's Frankenweenie. It's good enough.
I saw two movies that I'll talk about again. Trying to watch only horror movies in October, and sometimes I watch stuff that I know that I like, and sometimes I try and branch out and watch new things that aren't very good, especially because a lot of those are on Netflix Instant, and their offerings are not terrific this year.
They also take movies off of Netflix without announcing it in advance, and that could be very frustrating.
Very.
I really can't think of a concrete or even hypothetical example, but I've heard third hand that they can suddenly drop movies that, I don't know, hundreds of people are primed to see.
After watching Friday the 13th Part 3
to
do our commentary, I watched a couple other Friday the 13th movies. I don't know why. And I had said on the commentary that Friday the 13th Part 3 was my favorite of that series, and it probably still is because it's just the silliest, and that helps sort of that style of movie go down a little more easily.
That it's almost a parody of itself.
Yeah.
Almost.
It's not. But I watched part four, which was dubbed the final chapter. And I think part...
It wasn't.
It was not. But I think part four, if you're going to make a case that one of them is the best in the series, I think part four is... the best, and maybe it's because you have better actors. You have Crispin Glover and Corey Feldman and a couple other people that are recognizable. Lawrence Monison from The Last American Virgin. I mean, he's only made two movies. And Tom Savini comes back to do the makeup effects, and Joseph Zito is directing. And actually, we had the chance a couple years ago at the massacre. Joseph Zito came and showed Friday the 13th, the final chapter. I believe you slept. I think it's the best of the series, and it was interesting too because I had just rewatched and wrote about the Funhouse that Toby Hooper made, and there's a little brother character in the Funhouse, and he's obsessed with movie monsters, and I referred to him as a monster kid, which is a term I got from you, and Corey Feldman in Friday the 13th, the final chapter, is also a monster kid, and it was interesting. I don't want to spoil Friday the 13th, the final chapter, but I will just say that the I don't know if the movie's making a commentary on this, but the kid who loves monsters comes out on top over the lame slasher. And is that a commentary? I don't know. Is that Tom Savini? The kid seems to be playing, Corey Feldman seems to be playing sort of the child version of Tom Savini. I don't know. But that movie has some things going for it that the other movies don't. As that series as a whole is not very good. I also watched, because I rewatched The Funhouse and liked it so much, and I feel I have this theory that Toby Hooper is this really underrated director. And to prove myself wrong, I watched Eaten Alive, a movie that he made between Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Funhouse, about a weird sort of redneck guy running this hotel, maybe in Florida?
I believe it is.
And he kills people and feeds them to a giant gator. Or crocodile,
I suppose. But if he kills them before he feeds them to the gator,
yeah,
the gator is not eating them alive.
I guess not. Perhaps there's still some life left in them. He doesn't kill them.
Some stray nerve impulses. Complete tangent.
Yes.
On the Scary Movie Challenge, you posted your review, and Michael Angel Sanchez,
yes,
who's a real good friend of ours, posted this, which you will now be taking down because it's a comment.
I will
be,
yes.
Let me immortalize this. That when he was a child, he felt he was feeding a VHS tape of that horror film into the VHS player, only to discover it was a porno film with the same title, Eaten Alive.
Yes.
And at that point, friend of the podcast, Mike Pomero, asked him if he still had the tape and could he borrow it. That was funny.
Yeah. I was not crazy about Eaten Alive. I don't know what else to say.
I don't know what happens to these guys. Could it be argued that we can make a horror film about these young men who make these amazing horror films, and then something happens? Do you just get old? The audience changes? Did John Landis, John Carpenter, Toby Hooper, etc., did they sign a deal with the devil that only allowed each of them, like, to make four great films?
Maybe it's a case of, you know, all these guys set out to just make movies. They didn't necessarily set out to just make horror movies. And yet, they're pigeonholed very early on as horror filmmakers. They're only able to, you know, especially in the case of, like, George Romero, secure financing for horror movies. With Romero, it's only zombie horror movies.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, they have nothing else to say within that genre, and yet they're forced to continue to make horror movies, and so they don't have anything to say, but that's the only kind of movie they can make. I don't know.
I think you might have put your finger on it. Although many years ago, Romero brought a non-zombie film to the School of the Art Institute.
Was it Bruiser?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I am not a fan of Bruiser.
Nor am I.
So maybe when you reach a certain age, you have nothing left to say about anything.
Maybe.
And your little business card should say, have you seen Night of the Living Dead? Because that film is a masterpiece.
All right, let's talk about Universal Monsters.
I'm getting excited.
Patton Oswalt is off his meds.
When they announced it, they announced it a long time ago.
That the movies were coming out on Blu-ray. We haven't said that.
Yes. They're on Blu-ray now.
Yes.
And if any of you are grumbling, as many old men are on the Classic Horror Film Board, if some of you are grumbling about, what's the word? Trading up?
Yes.
There's a better word for it.
Upgrade?
You're up there. That's the word. That's the real word.
That's just the name of my pimp.
Yeah. Idiocracy reference. If any of you are feeling grim about upgrading, let me tell you a story. I have previously bought these films on VHS.
Yes.
On Laserdisc.
Yes.
On the original round of DVDs,
yes,
which were great because of the extras. And then Universal came out with the legacy sets that included the sequels and little busts of the monsters, courtesy...
That was when Van Helsing came out.
Right, courtesy of Sideshow.
The one good thing Van Helsing offered the world.
And then, little by little, they started to come out with 75th anniversary sets, which looked like cool hardcover books, and had some new extras, and now the Blu-rays. So I have bought the Blu-rays, and so, thanks to Universal, I have now bought these damn things 6 separate times. If you have bought them less than 6 separate times, no grumbling, because in all honesty, I don't like the bait and switch either. These look amazing. These look so good. Someone online described the picture on Dracula as astonishing. It's literally like watching the movie again for the first time. I know that was my experience with Dracula. Because I've had a rocky relationship with Dracula. There was a time where you liked it a lot more than I did.
Yeah.
You had said that when you sit down and the credits start and you hear that thing from Swan Lake, you just have to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And
by the way, that wears off about halfway through.
I was
reminded of that rewatching it.
And I'll admit that halfway through, it reveals its origins as sort of this stodgy turn-of-the-century parlor drama.
Yes.
And maybe it was just because I was so enthused about seeing things in the film that I had never seen before, or this time focusing even more on Lugosi's performance. It's like seeing the film again for the first time, and the restoration is nothing short of astonishing. There is a new bonus feature on the new Blu-ray, where they talk for 11 or 12 minutes about the restoration, and
yeah,
it's very instructive about how they're using the digital technology to even isolate one part of the frame and fix it so that it doesn't throw another part of the frame off balance. So these look much more detailed, but it's not as if they're playing with the white balance or the brightness or the what do they used to call that? The ratio of white to dark. Not you. I'm going back to what TVs used to have on the 60s. That there was that adjustment on old TVs that wasn't brightness. It was contrast. Where by adjusting the contrast for the slimy steps in Dracula's basement, they're not throwing off the contrast on the rest of the picture.
Right.
And on the restoration demo, they play that game that we all love where they show it the old one.
Then this line swipes
across. Yeah. And they're getting much better, not only at bringing out detail, but getting the film back to... I think in the past they've played a lot of games with brightness mm-hmm. that hurt the film. And what I'm seeing in the restoration demo, and clearly I'm now revealing that I'm not technically proficient in any of these things, what I'm noticing in the restoration demo is they're bringing out detail you never saw before, but also keeping it dark.
Right. Well, they're staying true to the source.
Right.
Which they don't always do, you know.
And that's astonishing to me. And they are still leaving in a little film grain so that it doesn't look polished or like a wax work or something.
Which I thought the Wolfman, you had told me to definitely check out the Wolfman, and it looks great. There were times where I felt like it was almost too polished.
That it's almost,
it has almost
like
no grain.
It gets to the point where it looks like you're looking at a videotape of a live television show.
Right.
From the 60s or something. Yeah. And again, I just assume that the Wolfman looks so great because you have 10 years.
Yeah, and I think that's honestly what it is.
Less.
Yeah.
Because it's an older film.
It's a huge leap forward from 31 to 41.
The picture's astonishing. I've been reading reviews online talking about the entire box. The restoration on Dracula is revelatory. It's unbelievable. And I had this theory that they deliberately laved more attention on Dracula, knowing that most people would pull that out of the box first.
Well, it's the first movie in the box.
And they would want a wow factor, at which point my wife said, well, how would they know that's the first one you'd pull out?
It's first.
Frankenstein is almost as good.
Yeah.
The Mummy's amazing. The Invisible Man looks great. I was actually disappointed by Bride of Frankenstein and felt, and my son said, maybe it's because of the 8, you've seen that one a lot more than the other 7. But Bride of Frankenstein is the one I show in class every year. So I am very familiar with the way that one looks. Mm-hmm. And I remember maybe 5 or 8 years ago, they did a mini restoration on it. And this, to me, looks very similar to that.
Okay.
It looks great. It's the best it's ever looked. It just didn't have the wow factor.
Right, that leap forward.
The Wolfman, again, is great, but that's 10 years younger, so to speak.
Yeah.
The creature looks similarly good, and someone mentioned, and I don't think I even noticed this because of our new TVs, it's the first time it's been in the correct aspect ratio.
Interesting.
That it's wide on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't notice it.
Yeah, right.
Listeners, the one thing I didn't get to, and something I'm noticing online, neither Patrick or I have a 3D Blu-ray player and a 3D television. The bonus feature on Creature from the Black Lagoon is that the film is in 3D. For the first time on home video, since that crappy VHS that came with the green and red glasses that didn't work, I keep meaning to take that disc to Best Buy and walk in and pretend that I'm in the market for a 3D system and tell the nice man, I brought my own demo disc. Can I watch 10 minutes of this? But I didn't get to it yet. Notice I left off Phantom. Phantom looks great.
It does.
I think Phantom is the only disappointment in the set. I think they want to claim the Phantom as one of the Universal monsters for a number of reasons. I'm not a big fan of the Claude Rains film. I would even argue that it's not really a horror film, that it's an elaborate...
But we might be jumping ahead, but let's get to that. I'm glad that they kept it in, if only because I think... And I think it's a mistake, you know, It's not up to the quality of the other movies. It's not really a Universal monster. It's not one that you consider part of the series. I would have rather they put in
the fact
Frankenstein meets the Wolfman or something.
The fact that Nelson Eddy is listed above Claude Rains in the credits gives you some idea of what you're in for.
However, I think if you're going to sort of track the progression of these movies, I think it's a great, I think it's an interesting piece of history, because you start with Dracula and they're sort of this little underground thing. Like, we're going to make this movie and it becomes this huge phenomenon, and all of a sudden Universal Monsters are a viable thing. And so through the, it progresses and you get a sequel in 35, and then you get to the Wolfman in 41, and it's this big production now.
And they almost did Son of Frankenstein in color. They came very close to doing Son of Frankenstein in color.
And so you get to Phantom of the Opera, and now Universal has gotten, they're a little too big for their britches, and they're trying to, you know what I mean? They got a little cocky.
I know exactly what you mean.
They're classing it up, and so it's this color, and they do it more of like a musical than a horror film, and it's just...
And it's a romance, and it's just that this one guy has a sort of a creepy makeup.
And it's not very good. And almost as a reaction, you get Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is almost a throwback to Dracula, except now it's the 50s, and so we have to be part of the gimmick, and so we're going to do it in 3D. And now they're almost playing catch-up as opposed to leading the pack, which is what they've been doing for all these years.
I wish, and I think I've expressed this in more than one place, they would have completely justified the inclusion of this misbegotten color musical in a Universal Monsters box if the bonus feature on that disc would have been the original Chaney version on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
However, there's a problem with that. And the reason why they remade Phantom so lavishly is that the original Chaney Phantom of the Opera made boatloads of money. Boatloads of money. You have no idea how much money it made. And it was made so close to the end of the silent era that when sound came in, they went in and they modified the film and add some sound sequences, and they hired an actor to voice Chaney when he's in the shadows and stuff. And they copyrighted that one, and they let the copyright on the silent one lapse, which is why Kino gets Phantom of the Opera on Blu-ray, which is already out.
Yeah.
And now all the restorations, like the Milestone Films restoration that Scott McQueen did, is the restored version is the silent version cobbled together from the sound version, because that's the best element.
Okay.
And the disc sort of tries to present both versions. It's a shame. But that's why they remade the Phantom, although it took them forever, because they wanted to reclaim that success. Phantom of the Opera and Hunchback of Notre Dame with Chaney made lots of money. Speaking of bonus features, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that I had bought these damn things so many times, and every time they came out, they had different extras. So VHS, bare bones. Laserdisc, trailer, usually a bad real art reissue trailer. And then suddenly, the David Scall supervised original DVDs had these little half-hour documentaries that were so much fun. And then the legacy sets had that Stephen Sommers stuff on it, but also a couple new bonuses, too.
Yeah, the Stephen Sommers stuff was worthless. But
and then the 75th...
So you got all the sequels almost as bonus features, which was the greatest.
And then the 75th anniversary books come out, and thank you, Universal. Suddenly, we get this documentary about Jack Pierce. Mm-hmm. And we get a separate documentary about Boris Karloff, and a separate documentary about Lugosi. And then that Universal Horrors documentary, which was originally on TCM, which is terrific, they actually put that on every 75th anniversary one, which got, you know, you could use that space for something else. My point is this. Now that we're at the Blu-ray, there's an embarrassment of riches to choose from.
Right.
And although I might be misspeaking, the Stephen Sommers stuff has been dropped.
Luckily.
Because those were just promotional things for Van Helsing. You pretty much get everything from the previous versions, which is really, really nice. And I haven't checked, but I believe they're all in 1080p, but don't quote me. They look great. I watch the Universal Horrors documentary again. Every time I sit down and start watching that, I watch the whole thing. I actually watched the Lugosi documentary for the first time. I had never watched that before. And it's really good. The talking heads they got are the best.
A couple weeks ago, we ran a post, and we were talking about, hey, what's everybody going to watch for Scary Movie Month? And a couple people said, you know, I'm actually going to go through the Universal Monsters for the first time. A bunch of people haven't seen these.
Which made me very happy.
Yeah, absolutely. If you haven't, seen these before, or you're interested in seeing them, or, you know, if you're just a horror fan, obviously you should buy this box set. I actually ordered mine from Amazon UK, because you can get it for about $50, which is a steal. The problem is it won't arrive in time for you to do your podcast on the Universal Monsters, so you have to borrow JB's box set so that you can comment on the quality of the Blu-rays.
And that is a substantial savings, and I wasn't quite sure if they were region-free.
Right.
They are. I ponied up for the American one, and Patrick waits patiently by his mailbox. But what I found out this morning is Patrick is not only going to pay less than half of what JB paid, and quite frankly, JB thinks he should have gotten these for free.
Yeah, really?
Just by turning in the proofs of purchases from the previous five sets.
or showing them your basement.
The English version, which you purchased, comes with something mine doesn't.
Really?
Little postcard size poster reproductions.
Oh.
Now, what the hell you're going to do with those?
They're going to sit in the case on my shelf.
I don't know, because yesterday I was noticing as you descend into Patrick's basement, into his sanctum sanctorum, into his home theater, it's pretty much the Blu-ray box on the wall, because pass almost every poster from the Universal Monsters, which makes me happy. In his old domicile, they were in the kitchen, which was even cooler, and is one of those examples of, your wife really loves you. Your wife loves you so much.
But then you get a house and you have to grow up, so they get stuck in the basement. You don't get to be cool anymore.
And as many people have commented, as some of you might imagine, my classroom looks like the inside of my brain. Because if I'm boring, I want to give my students something to look at. I always appreciated that when I was in high school, teachers who decorated their rooms. My classroom is full of all the stuff that used to be in my house until my wife got to that room, and then it goes to the classroom. So there's some very cool stuff in my classroom. I want to get back to bonus features.
Okay.
Two more things, and I'm sure these are just personal to me, but I'm the one talking. There are a couple new extras.
Okay.
On the Blu-ray box. I'm sure that some of these have appeared on some of the other Universal 100th Anniversary DVDs, and because they're comprised of clips, if the bonus feature, if the little featurette is called Memorable Characters, well, if there's a memorable character in Earthquake, we can put that featurette on Earthquake, and then they mention the Invisible Man, so we'll put it can do double duty. One of the extras is actually split over two movies, and it's called Universal 100th Anniversary, The Lot. And it's about the Universal Backlot. And it's so great.
All right.
It's so incredibly cool. And I've spoken of this before on my very first podcast. The arch that you can actually visit.
Mm-hmm.
I have yet to ask the tour guide to stop the bus so that I can get off the bus. They don't like when you get off the bus. I know that. They're not going to let me off the bus. There's a stone archway that's part of the little European village that has a fountain in the middle of it.
Okay.
Now, I've heard a rumor that actually burnt down, and they rebuilt it. So it might not be the original from all these films.
Right.
But I would like to pretend that it is. Because they did a real good job recreating it. There's a stone arch that if you've ever seen the original Universal films, it's in Frankenstein, it's in Bride of Frankenstein, it's in all those films. It's in the Wolfman. It's the little town where the antique store is in the Wolfman. And it's the arch. I learned from this bonus feature that is called the Court of Miracles. Because the fountain is actually from the original Hunchback of Notre Dame, and they just kept redressing it and repurposing it. That arch is like a religious relic to me. And, you know, part and parcel of this desire to be able to live in a Universal horror film, which is impossible because you'd have to be in black and white. Although, because we're in color, we are, folks.
Yeah.
That would mean we'd have to be in the remake of Phantom, which I don't want to be in.
But there's so much singing. I mean, there's so much singing.
And the other thing I thought, and this was just a fantasy for those of you who are really into Universal Monster films, What if somewhere on this box, and I'm looking at the box right now, there's an Easter egg, and no one's found it yet.
Okay.
But somehow Universal put it on this, because a lot of attention was laid on this to get it right.
Because
people who like Universal horror films are a very quibbling crowd. They finally got this right. I keep wondering if on one of these 8 discs, they found Bela Lugosi's audition for Frankenstein. They filmed the screen test.
Okay.
With him wearing makeup.
Okay.
And Edward Van Sloan and Dwight Frye are in it.
Right.
We have proof that it was filmed. Carl Laemmle Jr. ordered the screen test. And apparently people laughed. Because it wasn't Boris Karloff makeup.
Right.
It was something Lugosi and Pierce came up with. It's gone.
Okay.
It's lost to history. But I would so like to think that maybe a year from now, I'll be canoodling around on the menu, and I'll be the first one to find it.
Sure.
And
that's definitely going to happen.
You might want to turn the sound down on this, because if I ever were to come upon that, I'm going to turn now so I don't hurt your ears.
Okay.
I've seen that bonus feature. Clickety, clickety, click. What's... Oh, if you move the cursor to the right, Frankenstein's ear lights up. What might that be? Jesus Christ! Jesus! It's the original audition of Bela! It's a good number! So, I had this dream that might happen.
It for sure will. My understanding was always that it was Lugosi did not want to play Frankenstein.
Well, you know...
And he did eventually anyway.
History, but. And we saw how well that went. Although that wasn't his fault, because the studio made some post-production decision. which you'll hear about if you buy this set and watch the bonus features, that history has a funny way of telling the same story a lot of ways,
yeah.
And Lugosi apparently was proud and didn't want to be buried under makeup. But
right.
I believe he had some interest in it, hence the screen test.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after the screen test did not go well and then, of course, this leads to Karloff becoming this amazingly big star at Universal, which is another story in itself. If you're interested in this, William Gregory Mank, keep confusing his name, has written an amazing book. It's McFarland Books just published he revised it. It's called Lugosi and Karloff, and it's kind of amazing. I would recommend that book in spades.
So let's get away from the Blu-rays.
Okay.
And let me just ask you, who holds these movies above most others, I would say.
Yes, I came to the conclusion earlier today that I not only love them, but I fetishize them, which is disturbing.
Why these movies above all others?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons, and a lot of them sort of come down to sort of psychoanalyzing myself, which
okay.
I'm not comfortable with.
That's fine.
But when I was very small, I was very afraid of them. And I think that's true of a lot of Monster Kids, and a lot of our love of it has to do with mastering it or taming it or being in control of something that we're actually very scared of. I think there's something in all the Universal Classic Monsters that appeals to people on some level, especially to a child. Dracula's control over other people. The utter sadness of Frankenstein, which I commented on last week on the our favorite monsters, that Frankenstein is this being who really didn't ask to come into the world and is abandoned and mistreated, and all he's looking for is some acceptance. And I think that's something that we can all identify with. The Mummy takes the exact same themes of Dracula. In fact, a lot of people think Mummy is the unofficial sequel,
yeah, right.
unofficial remake of Dracula, because it's almost the exact same script, that this desire for a love that will transcend time. Karloff is just so mesmerizing in his pursuit of that poor girl. And, it's, we can build a life together, but honey, first you have to die. There's a little codicil. Watching Invisible Man again, I think the same is true. It's sort of this childish desire for power and control. Although watching it again for this podcast, really amazed at how what a sense of humor that film has. I mean, Whale is known for doing things tongue-in-cheek, but there's a lot of really funny stuff in Invisible Man. Bride of Frankenstein is my favorite horror film of all time. We've talked about this on several podcasts, that sort of the combination of the creepy gothic Germanic influence and all of these trappings of horror films, of the castles and the bats and the cobwebs, and then suddenly this really twisted sensibility that enters with Pretorius and the little people, and that he's forcing the newly married man away from his marriage and into this unholy alliance and things, and you're not quite sure what to take seriously, and the production value that they gave that film, I mean, that's really an A-list production. You can tell that they spent a lot of money and a lot of time. Phantom of the Opera, Boo.
Yeah.
The Wolfman, I've always thought, is probably the best example, except for maybe Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is a shame that the Frederick March version was made for Paramount instead of Universal, because the Frederick March Dr. Jekyll belongs on this set more than...
You take Phantom out and you put that in, and you have...
Yeah, you have all the horror in the 30s.
Yeah.
But the Wolfman will suffice for this sort of, not just the trope of the shapeshifter, but also the fact that a lot of horror films deal with things that we have inside of us that we never let out. And Creature from the Black Lagoon, even not in 3D, and I've seen it in 3D several times. Rusty showed it at one of the first massacres. It's just a really fun gee whiz 50s, I don't want to call it a boys adventure film. I tend to call it a boys adventure film, too much. And I now realize that I'm long winded and I haven't answered your question. I don't know why I'm talking about things that I like about the films, but why do you hold the things close to your heart that you hold close to your heart?
It's a hard question to answer.
Why do you like pie more than cake?
Right.
These films are my pie.
Yeah, I mean, for me, these were the entry point, possibly not even to just horror movies, possibly to all movies. I mean, the earliest movies that I can remember being obsessed with were these movies. And I would even say, I don't even know if I had seen them.
And
this was just from reading about them and looking at pictures. I don't even know at what age I saw some of these movies, but I was in a constant state of checking out the books about them from the library.
And I can speak to this because I think our experiences with this were very similar, although separated by 20 years, that there was a time when it was very difficult to see some films and you'd have to read about them. So all the young adult books about monsters, and I think we've talked about some and even seen some being sold used at Comic-Cons and things, we both read the same books. But also, I know that my love of film, what led me to study it in college and then eventually teach it for so long in high school, that started with my love of the Universal Monsters, that the Universal Monsters was my gateway drug into the larger world of film. That I know for sure.
Mine too.
Although, recently the release of the Dark Shadows box has me thinking, because I was very young when that was originally on television, that I would run home from kindergarten and watch it, and I had never seen anything like it, that I had forgotten about it, but I think Dark Shadows on TV was my road to the Universal Monsters.
Okay.
Because given my age, I think Dark Shadows and Scholastic books, remember Scholastic books? You could order them and then,
because
it was a long time ago, you'd have to wait what seemed like a really long time. And then it was usually a Friday. The teacher would say, the books are in. And my parents would always buy me books. And then you could laugh at the kids who didn't get books. Because remember when books were a big deal?
Yeah.
I remember when books were a big deal. And Scholastic was really good about putting stuff out, especially around Halloween. Some books for little kids about horror films. So I turn the question to you.
Yeah.
You held these very close to your heart from an early age.
Yes.
And I'm thinking now, maybe the key is the early age.
Yeah.
Why do you have so much affection for them?
I mean, it's got to be the same sort of a thing. You know, the thing that I remember is the images of these monsters. I was immediately just drawn to the actors, the makeup, whatever, and then I wanted to know everything I could. These are the movies that I first learned about the productions of, and I still know facts about the productions of some of these movies from these books that I read when I was 5 years old. And I obviously, I mean, I don't know a tenth of what you know about, especially these movies, but, you know.
And a little bit of it you learned in my class, because sure. I certainly sort of pushed that.
Sure.
And for the longest time, the best description of why Jack Pierce made Frankenstein's monster's makeup the way he did comes to us from a book called The Frankenstein Legend by Donald F. Glute. And for the longest time, I assigned a chapter from that book as a reading assignment. And just as an anecdote, he was recently at Horribles in Berwyn, which is a store that sells horror movie stuff, signing his new book, which I would recommend. It's pretty terrific. And I brought my copy of The Frankenstein Legend to ask him to sign it and to kind of say thanks, because he was a big part of what got me interested in this. And when I came in the store and showed him the book, his first response was, because it's like the first edition, he said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "I was 11. I think a relative must have bought it for me as a birthday or a Christmas present." And he said, "Because not many people have that edition. And how did an 11-year-old get his hands on that edition?" And we had a nice short chat, but it was really nice to be able to talk to the person who sort of had set you on this road. It was sort of neat, and I got a lot out of it.
These are the movies that, you know, essentially invented the horror film.
And the horror film in a very specific way, because this is almost becoming a cliche. But people didn't put their finger on this until way late, as far as I'm concerned. In silent films, horror wasn't horror. It was an insurance investigator pretending to be a vampire, or it was a very bad man trying to scare all the people in the house so he would inherit it. Dracula and Frankenstein are very important because the films say these monsters are real. Mm-hmm. In fact, the other thing they couldn't find is, much like Edward Van Sloan makes an opening speech in Frankenstein, "Hello, we're about to present the story of..." It's very fruity and yeah. It's very wonderful. "It may shock you. It could horrify you." He did something very similar, because this is actually in the play script. At the end of Dracula on stage, the actor who plays Van Helsing comes out on stage and has this little coda for the audiences that's really terrific. Have you ever heard it?
No.
And they can't find it.
No.
He comes out on stage and he says, "You've just seen all of this." This is the most horrible paraphrase you're ever going to hear, but "You've just seen all this. But all the people behind this film are hoping that when you go home tonight, if you should hear something odd or feel something strange, you'll remember there are such things." Blackout. Oh my God, what a quantum leap that is from the silent films. Dracula's real.
Right. And rewatching it, there's a sequence where... And we were just talking about it, where it's the cut on the finger, where Dwight Frye cuts his finger, and there's a shot of his bleeding finger, and we cut to Lugosi, you know, freaking out, because he wants that blood. And in 2012, that means nothing to us, but in 1931, I can't even imagine people's heads exploding at the thought of this man wants to drink that blood that we're looking at on camera, and what a revelation that was. I just, you know, these are the movies that are credited with inventing the horror movie. And so we watch them as people who love movies, as people who love horror movies. And Jesus, this is everything that we love about movies. Are in these eight movies, or these, let's say, six movies. but I wonder if, you know, we have a terrific fan base who loves movies, who are willing to expand their horizons and explore older movies, who love horror movies, who are willing to write 7-word reviews, you know, for possibly 1,000 movies in the month of October. And so these are people who are willing to investigate the Universal Monster movies. But I worry that, and we've talked about this before, that this is going away or whatever, but to people who maybe don't have these same interests, they would watch these movies and not understand what the appeal is, because in 2012, they're not scary. And it comes down to only that. And I had a conversation with Doug recently about this, and it's kind of going to come up on the website, maybe this week, maybe next week, about what you look for in a horror movie. And there's a lot of people who would argue, well, if I'm not scared, it's not good. And I don't think most of these movies in 2012 are scary. Now, you know, a lot of people aren't willing to give them credit for the fact that in the 30s they were terrifying to people. But they're not anymore. So what do they have to offer us beyond, you know, scaring us?
That's a hard question to answer, because I think because of the way I define being scared, mm-hmm. they still scare me. But not in the same way that, oh, I don't know, just to pick one, a more recent film like VHS might scare me.
Right.
That scares me in a very different way. This has come up occasionally on the Classic Horror Film Board, a message board that I really love and treasure. And, of course, I go to all these conventions, and monster kids are getting older. And the kids who were first turned on to this stuff in the early 60s, early 70s, we're in our 50s and 60s now. And every so often, someone will bring up, our hobby is going to die. But I'm not so sure. Because I go to other conventions, like Flashback, and I think I've been to Fangoria once. And while it's certainly not the same as Wonderfest or Monster Bash or even Flashback Weekend, it is a form of that for younger people.
Sure.
So I don't know if it's evolving. I'd like to think that if you're really into horror films, you can at least enjoy and acknowledge what these 8 films represent. But you're right. For some people, it's an insurmountable hurdle. I am not scared by this.
Right. And horror films, I think it's sort of the only subgenre where it's so varied, where there's so many different kinds of movies that offer so many different things to so many different kinds of people, and just within the horror community, it's so sort of fragmented. Well, I like this kind of horror movie and this kind of horror movie. And sometimes I get depressed. I mean, I love to be at sort of horror marathons, horror screenings, conventions, whatever, because I feel like, hey, I'm with my people. And yet sometimes I feel very alone, because I'm like, oh, wait, these people are into this for a very different reason. These are people who are, you know, Herschel Gordon Lewis fans. They yes. just love the gore. These are people who just love Italian zombie movies, which, again, is more about the gore. And so
this man's a Fulci fan.
While I don't think the love of horror movies is going away, I worry sometimes about a certain kind of horror movie that doesn't offer the same things that a lot of people are into. I worry about that going away. And again, you hope that the people who love these movies tend to be, hopefully, smarter people, more film literate people, who would at least have an appreciation for the origins and who are at least willing to give credit to the Universal Monsters. But I do sometimes worry about...
Here's a ray of hope.
Yes.
Or we could be really cynical about it. Universal, laving lots of money and attention on these 8 films, indicate that they still think there's an audience out there.
Yeah.
And I was hoping removing decades of gunk from Dracula might make the film more accessible. So the optimist in me says, there is still a market for this, or else the Blu-rays would not have come out. I mean, they're sort of the crown jewels of Universal early period, and as I never tire of pointing out, Universal would have gone bankrupt if it weren't for Dracula and Frankenstein. Those two films saved the studio. That's why I go on the tour. I don't understand why more isn't made of that.
Yeah.
Because it is part of their history. On the other hand, could the release of the Blu-rays be Universal very cynically saying, we have to put these out now, because the only people who care about these are going to die soon?
they're the only people who are still buying physical media. Yeah.
But won't these transfers trickle down, and I hate to use that word, to a possible Netflix streaming, or TCM will get these transfers the next time they show them? Down the road, maybe when Svengoolie shows them, you'll notice, hey, this looks good. Because one thing, and I don't think this is a tangent because we're talking about transfers. The other day, IFC showed Night of the Living Dead in a transfer that was unbelievably better than anything I've ever seen. And I had that original Elite Laserdisc of Night of the Living Dead and the Blu-ray version of it.
Okay.
I thought part of it was that it was IFC HD, and I'm just not yet used to watching it in HD. I mean, I sat there and I said, and I turned to my wife and I said, it's not just me, is it? And she said, no, that's outstandingly good.
It's different from the one that's on the Blu-ray that you have?
It looks different to me.
Interesting. Maybe there's another one coming down the pike. I don't know. Last thing, and then we'll wrap up. Bride of Frankenstein is your favorite of the Universal Monsters.
Yes.
The gentleman who does the audio commentary, whose name I can't remember, Scott something? On the Blu-ray. I don't remember. It's not important. He introduces it as, welcome to, you know, I'm going to be talking about Bride of Frankenstein, a perfect horror movie.
Yes.
And I think that's an apt description of that movie. Removing Bride of Frankenstein, what's your next favorite?
That always changes.
Okay.
But having just spent a lot of time on the universe, on the new Universal Blu-ray set, I'd say it's now Dracula.
Interesting. Okay.
And I went through about a decade of really not liking that film very much.
Yeah.
Because Heath Holland pointed this out in a recent thing for the Scary Movie Challenge. After the first 20 minutes, which is terrific, it slows down.
Yeah.
And that slowness bothered me. For some reason, watching the Blu-ray, I was now fascinated by the slowness.
Okay.
Although, watching Dracula again on the Blu-ray, and the Spanish Dracula again on the Blu-ray, and watching the little featurette, because Skull's an even bigger expert on this, because he pretty much rediscovered the Spanish version. I somehow wish that we could have the Spanish version with Lugosi in it.
Right. That's the best possible version of Dracula.
That would be something. Yeah. And again, I guess they didn't want to dub it, so the American crew filmed during the day, and then a separate crew directed by George Melford with Spanish actors filmed at night. And apparently the first thing the Spanish crew did was watch the dailies from Todd Browning and the Americans and say, how can we make this better?
Yeah.
The only problem is Carlos Villarreal as the Count, the less said the better. Man, imagine when technology gets advanced enough, not just restoring the film, they Photoshop Lugosi into the Spanish version.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, it's interesting to watch because I watched Dracula just on my DVD and then I watched Frankenstein on the Blu-ray and there's only a year separating them. And I like Dracula a lot. I've talked about that before. But Todd Browning is one of the problems with Dracula, yes. I think. And I mean, I love Todd Browning because he's crazy. And I'm fascinated by him. But he's what stands in that movie's way sometimes. To watch Dracula and then Frankenstein, there's only a year separating them. But just what a better filmmaker James Whale is than Todd Browning. And what a leap forward Frankenstein feels like just as a piece of filmmaking.
Browning was very much stuck in the silent days. And again, rewatching the bonus features, I discovered that when you're watching the American Dracula and you're watching the beginning and you start to try to wrap your mind around the fact that those are armadillos and then possums, the bonus features explain why. In America at that time, it was considered bad to show rats for any number of reasons. That it was filthy, people didn't want to see rats, it would cause a panic, I don't know, some nonsense. The Spanish version has rats, because that film was supervised far less than that. Although I've grown to love it, because of course it's part of the film, whenever we get to the armadillos, I just sit there and scratch my head. You know, Patrick, they're scary armadillos. Are we adequately conveying our love of these films?
I would assume so. I mean, right, there's not necessarily anything that we're going to say that would convince, oh, I should watch these for the first time, because I was worried it would be the Chris Farley show, obviously, but
I don't think we did that.
There was one more question that I wanted to ask, but I'm not going to ask it.
I wish I could more adequately answer your first question.
Sure.
Because then I would have insights into my soul.
It's a hard question. Like I said, it's a hard question
but
to
answer. But now that you throw it out that you're not going to ask the last question, I need to know.
Well, because I know what your immediate response will be, and it will just be to really poo-poo it.
I'm not going to give you my immediate response. Okay. I'm going to wait and give you my more thoughtful response.
There's a school of thought that in the 80s, there was sort of a second wave of... There are people who compare the horror icons of the 80s to sort of the new Universal Monsters, or the Universal Monsters for that generation, your Jasons and your Freddies and your Leatherfaces. And I just wanted to get your reaction to that.
I completely agree with that.
Okay.
Completely agree. A couple years ago, I put together a PowerPoint for
my
classes.
Isn't that so depressing, though? I don't mean
to
interrupt.
No, I don't find it depressing at all. I really don't. I put together a PowerPoint for my students where I sort of take them through the history of horror and describe it in terms of five epics. And I call the Universal 30s the Golden Age.
Yeah.
And I call the 80s the Silver Age.
Okay.
I don't have any problem with that. And with the exception of one monster, and you know who that is, I really like those other films.
Yeah.
I recognize they're very different from the Universal films.
Maybe I'm getting hung up on that same monster. Because as much as I want to say, like, oh, come on, you can't compare Freddy Krueger to Dracula or whatever.
In a heartbeat.
You can, because I think Nightmare on Elm Street is a masterpiece also. And what I'm getting hung up on is that I forget that, oh, there were 10 sequels to Dracula of lesser quality, right, just as there were of Nightmare on Elm Street.
I love Michael. I love Leatherface. I love Freddy. At this point, everyone can figure out what I'm
right,
talking about.
Right.
And even other lesser films that sort of surround that. And I'm curious, because at that point I'm 18. And I sort of missed that firsthand, because I was in college and concentrating on other things. But I love that happened.
Okay.
And now, in the basement, I'm pointing to the Sideshow Premium 18-inch statues of all the monsters we're talking about, and how you go around the room, and it's a continuum. I keep waiting for the third wave. In comic book talk, we have the Golden Age, we have the Silver Age. Is there a third?
Bronze Age.
Really?
I guess, yeah.
I keep waiting for the Bronze Age
to
happen before I die.
I don't know if we're going to get it, but that's a conversation for another day.
Okay.
We will wrap it up. Everybody, go to fthismovie.net. Keep participating in the Scary Movie Challenge. I'm going to try and put it maybe a tab at the top of the site where you could, for easy access. Otherwise, it's not hard to find. You can find it. Scroll through or find a link to it somewhere. We keep trying to do it. Thanks for listening. Get the Universal Monster Blu-rays.
Oh, my God.
And let's continue to have a great October. Thanks, everybody.
I'm going to go watch them again.